Welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Jordan Calhoun, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker, and joining me is Lifehacker's parenting editor, Megan Wahlberg. Hey, Megan.
Hi, Jordan.
Megan, today we're learning to pare down, right?
That's right. We're learning to live with less with help from the Afro-minimalist Christine Platt.
Everyone just wants to jump right in. They're like, I'm ready to go into my closet. I'm ready to find what sparks joy, and I'm getting rid of everything that doesn't, right? But it's like, until you understand why you have all those things that don't spark joy, you run the risk of finding yourself in that same space over and over again.
In addition to being the Afro-minimalist online, Christine is also the managing director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University.
She's also an accomplished author, having written over 24 books for both children and adults. Her latest book is called The Afro-Minimalist Guide to Living with Less, and she joined us this week to talk about how to approach a minimalist lifestyle.
Megan, have you taken a swing at being a minimalist? What's your relationship with clutter?
I feel like I'm a minimalist simply because of situationally. So I believe you could call me a pack rat. In my former life.
When I think that's the opposite of minimalism, right?
It is. When I was growing up, like I'm picturing like my childhood bedroom and like just dozens of stuffed pigs. Like you don't need this many stuffed pigs, but like I couldn't get rid of a stuffed pig. So, but once I moved out and I'm, you know, living on my own, I've lived in a lot of places where we've just been like super low on storage. So like the home I live in now was built in 1925. When they did not believe in closets. And so because of that, I've had to get better at trying to pare down. But there's definitely still some areas where I could be doing better. I don't know. What about you?
Gotcha. So I am pretty minimalist, actually. And that comes, I think, by my childhood experience of moving around a lot. I think anyone who's moved a ton or maybe has traveled a ton or has had several homes or apartments has had the experience of realizing just how hard it is to pack and move up when you have more things. And so since I bounced around a lot as a kid and then ended up traveling and leaving the country and just moving around a lot, I ended up just wanting to shed and get rid of all the stuff that I would have to pack. I just had this, you know, I really in my bones felt this feeling of the more stuff you own, the more stuff you have to move around, the more your stuff sort of owns you. So I got pretty good at just having a regular purge of my things where I'll donate them or I'll throw them away and I try to keep as little as possible. Also, in a similar situation to you, where if you don't have the storage space for it, I live in a small New York City apartment. Like, I don't have places to keep a lot of clutter. I don't have a garage to store things in. And I vowed long ago that I wouldn't be a person who paid for storage space. Right. So that's basically sort of kept me in check. But yeah, there's always more that I feel that I need / want to get rid of.
Well, it's like a very cleansing feeling, I feel like. It can be overwhelming to start doing it, but then once you get through a closet or a cabinet and you're, you know, seeing more space in there now and your stuff is leaving your home, it just feels like, like a renewal.
Yeah, I feel it's the same way that I feel about running, where afterwards I've never regret a run. Like, I've never regret getting rid of some stuff. There's always sort of that moment where you're like, should I keep this or should I throw this away? And then you're always worried, like, what if I need it later? Or what if I'll really want it later? And it at least in my experience, it's never happened. I've never regretted it afterwards. I've never been like, oh, I wish I held on to this thing for this one occasion that I would need it. So it's been, absolutely cleansing. And I'm looking forward to hearing from Christine and getting some tips on how we can live a more minimalist lifestyle.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Christine, thanks for joining The Upgrade. So glad to have you.
Thank you. I am so, so happy to be here. Thank you.
All right. So I want to start with a story here because your book talks about this personal journey that you have towards minimalism. And I want people to hear the context behind how you got to where you are now. So can you describe, sort of give that summary of how you became a minimalist, how you reached that lifestyle?
Sure. So I went on this journey. I think I started like most people believing, you know, oh, I'm just going to declutter my closet and I have like all this stuff in my house. And so I ended up really just sort of like doing what I saw online, which was putting everything in a pile, which on television looks so simple, but in real life is like completely traumatizing. Right. And so I had just, you know, pulled everything out of my closet and was just completely overwhelmed. I mean, like, I'm like, no one ever talks about the emotions that come with this process. I mean, I cried, I felt guilty, I was angry, like all of these different things.
On TV, you get it in a montage. The montage is really effective.
I mean, the montage will set you up. And I was set up. I was not prepared.
You were bamboozled.
I was bamboozled.
Run amok, Christine.
Listen, man, I was bamboozled. And it was so wild because, you know, once all your stuff is out, I mean, like, that's the thing. You, like, you got to figure it out, right? So I'm sitting there and I'm feeling like terrible. And I was just like, I mean, I have to forgive myself, right? Like, I have to forgive myself. And so that was sort of the beginning of my journey in me sort of establishing a four-step approach that will lead people to a more holistic approach to living with less and letting go, you know. And I feel like so many times we miss that step of forgiveness and like acknowledging those emotions, right? And so I had already acknowledged that I had too much, but then I had to forgive myself, and then I had to let go, and then I had to learn to pay it forward with those things that no longer served me. And so what ended up happening through that journey, it led to me, you know, sharing my philosophy with other people and what happened and developing, like I said, this four-step approach. Then the second part of that was that when I had let go of everything, I'm like, all right, now I got to get this minimalist aesthetic right, you know, like I got to look like Pinterest. And, you know, so I had this all white, barren aesthetic and I hated it. Like I absolutely hated it. And I was like, I can't live like this. Like, I can't live like this. And so that's what led to me becoming the Afro minimalist. And I was like, I have to infuse some elements of my history and culture and those things that are important to me into my minimalism practice. And so began my journey. And so I like to tell people all the time, authenticity over aesthetics, because if you just go with the aesthetics, like you're going to lose every time. I tried it. So like just learning to be authentic. And now here I am, like, it, you know, it is my life. It's beautiful. I love it so much. I tell people all the time, like, there's no way that you can just be intentional with your wardrobe, right? Or just with like what you have in your garage. Intentionality sort of ends up trickling into every area of your life. And so that's where I am.
Yeah. You're mentioning that intentional living, which is like a really interesting component, I think, of how you approach this, as opposed to maybe how other minimalists out there that maybe we're more familiar with or have been around, you know, for years and years. And so I'm wondering how you, can you talk a little bit about what that intentionality looks like in practice? How does that seep into other aspects of life?
Yes. And I want to talk about some of the other minimalist practitioners, because I do feel like so many of them, so many of us have gems that you should take and gems that you should leave. Right. And, you know,
talk about it.
Josh and Ryan are phenomenal. They're the minimalists, right? Like everyone has seen the documentary, everyone has read their blog, right? And I mean, they were where I started, like so many other people. Courtney Carver, Marie Kondo, I've KonMari'd my closet a million times, right? I do it literally every season, you know, and it's just so important to be intentional about what parts of other people's minimalist philosophy is going to work with you. So I like to tell people, like, what you're doing is sort of building your own minimalist practice and philosophy, right? And it's a very prominent adage in the African-American community, which is, you know, take a little, leave a little, right? And so that's how I look at this advice. You take a little that works with you, you might have to leave a little, right? And so for me, being intentional about what sort of information that I take in that informs my practice is part of it. Being intentional about what I allow into my life, right? So that's the other thing, people let go. And then they're like, I don't understand. 6 months later, my house is full. I'm like, you weren't intentional. those last 6 months, right? And you have to be, and I think the tough part about intentionality is that people have to learn to say no, right? Like that's honestly the hardest part, learning to say no. And whether that be, you know, gifts from grandparents for your children, like, oh my God, she does not need another toy, right? Like the minute you say, we'll take it, you start to form an attachment to it and you feel responsible for it, right? So intentionality just like really informs every area of my life, but specifically what I accept and allow into my life. And that is what has allowed me to maintain a lifestyle with less.
You know, I did want to ask you about that because I do understand that you're a parent. I'm a parent as well. And like the Lego struggle is just very real in my house.
The Lego struggle is real, man. It is real.
It is. So I'm wondering, you know, especially as a parent and, you know, having a child who, you know, might have grandparents that want to spoil the child, how do you set those boundaries with relatives? And how do you, that's maybe part one. And then part two is when you're living with other people in your home and you want this intentionality, how do you sort of drag the rest of your family along with you?
Megan, this is a question I'm asked so often. So first I'm going to start with a parent's question because this is like twofold. These are like two very separate.
This is what I need.
Right? Okay. So first, parents, because I have been there. And Megan, like, honestly, we had the Lego struggle, but we also had the American Girl doll struggle. So I had a kid. I mean, like, can you ask for anything worse? Like, you love Legos and you love American Girl doll? Like,
what? It's a perfect storm.
Right. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think that the hardest thing for me to sort of accept and acknowledge as a parent, and I like to tell people all the time, minimalism is such a process of self-discovery. So keep in mind, Megan, these are things that I discovered along this journey. Okay. And, you know, one of the hardest things for me to accept was that I was enabling and responsible for all of the excess and overconsumption that my child had because she had no job. Right? Right. You know?
It's not on her.
It's not on her, or as her cousin likes to say, her cousin Mary, I mean, they're all older now, but when they were younger, her cousin Mary is so funny. And she used, anytime we said no about anything, she would say, children have no rights. That was her thing, right? And so like, children have no rights, right? So why are we acting like their overconsumption is their fault? Okay. We are enabling and allowing these things into their lives, whether we are doing it out of guilt, whether we are fulfilling our own childhood wants and expectations that weren't fulfilled. You know, there are so many reasons why we feel compelled to spoil, if you want to use that word, or, you know, just give this life of abundance to our children that they're really not asking for. At the end of the day, most children are completely overwhelmed with all that they have been given. All of these toys, all of these things, all of these Lego, it's just so much. And so one sort of story that I like to tell, and I hope that you use this in your life, Megan, with your children, is my daughter's 8th birthday party. She's turning 8 years old. I was not yet a minimalist, but I was on my way. And what I did realize was that she had so much. I was like, there's literally nothing we can buy her for her birthday. And I remember, you know, we were like, what do you want for your birthday? And, you know, you get that with your kids. And they're like, I don't know, right? Like, that is a sign. I already have enough. Like, I don't even know what I want. And I was just like, we're not bringing another toy into this house. And what we ended up doing was hosting a carnival in our backyard. And the cost of admission, all her friends had to bring one canned good to get into the carnival. We were going to donate them to the Interfaith Food Pantry in our community. And we ended up literally having like shopping carts full of donations of food for our Interfaith Food Pantry. The kids had a blast at that birthday party. To this day, it is the, my daughter's 17 now, literally getting ready to go to college. I'm so grateful. But like literally to this day, it's the only birthday that she remembers, speaks fondly of, has memories of. Like all the birthdays where I did all this elaborate stuff, she doesn't even remember. Like what she remembers is her friends signing this card for the food pantry, her dropping off those donations, and her making an impact, right? And so I think there are so many ways that we can still celebrate birthdays, celebrate these special occasions, love on our children, but not with things. You have to learn to say no, whether it's to yourself, whether it's to grandma and grandpa, whether it's to, you know, friends and family. She doesn't need another thing. And usually what I do is offer a solution. She doesn't need another thing, but you know, her birthday is in July and that's usually a big back to school time. So why don't you donate a backpack full of supplies in her honor to da da da, you know what I mean? Like offering people a solution or another alternative usually proves to be really, really helpful. So that is my advice for parents. We are enablers. We know we are.
Yes, we are.
Right? Like, you're smiling.
I have some Lego soul searching to do when we get off this call.
Right?
I got to take a good long look in the mirror.
Right? But no, like, I mean, and, you know, again, even if it's not our unfulfilled childhood wants and needs, right, it could be from guilt, right? Like sometimes single parent guilt, like that was a big thing for me. You know, so there's all these reasons why we end up giving our children so much more than what they need. And secondly, that second part of your question about our partners, right? It's so funny because I get that all the time and I'm like, so why don't we start with you? I know you're, concerned about your partner, but why don't we start with you? Right. And so I think one of the biggest lessons that we can teach our partners and people that we care about is showing them how we are embracing this lifestyle and the benefits that it has shown us, right? Like, I mean, the old adage is true. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And so rather than focus on what your partner is or is not doing, more so focus on, you know, bringing that authenticity and intentionality into your own life. The other thing that I talk about in the book that I think is important for not even just partners, I would even say siblings and friends to do together, is before you start this process of letting go, like first understanding why you have more than you need. Why are you even at this place of overconsumption, right? Because everyone just wants to jump right in. They're like, I'm ready to go into my closet. I'm ready to find what sparks joy and I'm getting rid of everything that doesn't, right? But it's like, until you understand why you have all those things that don't spark joy, you run the risk of finding yourself in that same space over and over again, which is why I'm like, I know people are going to be super shocked that the book does not start with, here's how you let go. The book starts with first understanding why you have more than you need and why it's so hard to let go. And once you go through the self-discovery process of understanding those two things, which are number one, rooted in like understanding why you have more than you need. There's so many things. We talked about childhood, right? But there's also societal expectations. There's mindless consumption, there's conspicuous consumption, right? There's all these things that sort of play into why we have more than we need, but then also understanding why it's so hard to let go, which is rooted in our attachments to things, right? So I had to really understand the psychology of ownership. So the psychology of ownership, so most of us are familiar with the legality of ownership, which is like, this is this is legally mine, right? I legally own this. But the psychology of ownership is believing something is yours, right? And so the best example I can give is actually we can use children, right? And we can use Legos although I like to use, like, think about them at a park or even in a, even when we go to the store, right? And you give them like a roll of toilet tissue or something to play with just to like distract them. And then you get to the register and you're like, okay, put the toilet tissue back. And they're like, no, it's mine, right? And it's like this strong belief that something is yours, right? We really have a lot of commentary about children about it, but we are just as guilty. When it comes time to like turn something loose, we are akin to children, like kicking our feet, screaming, no, 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 right? Because we have formed attachments. And so one of the things that was so important that I thought people understand was how the psychology of ownership happens. And believe it or not, touch is a really big part of that. So the minute you touch something, you form this idea of having partial ownership. And that partial ownership leads to you wanting to exert full ownership, which is why you have to get the thing before someone else gets the thing, right? It's why car dealerships are like, test drive the car, right? Or stores are like, try on those clothes. They understand the power of touch and how once you have that feeling of partial ownership, that you then want to exert full ownership, right? And once you have full ownership and you bring that in, those attachments start to form and they only deepen over time. And so this is why it's so hard to let go of some things. It was so powerful for me to learn this because I just could not understand why it was so hard for me. Like, why is it so hard for me to let go of this thing that I don't even use? Why is it so hard? But I formed an attachment to it. And even when we take in things that we don't want, you know, those ugly sweaters or, you know, gifts that we get from people, and we know in the moment when we're saying yes that we don't really want it, but we take it in, the attachment that we have is that we feel responsible for it. And so, again, it's so important, I think, to first understand why you have more than you need, why it's so hard for you to let go of certain things before you even begin the process of trying to release those things that no longer serve you.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Let's say that someone goes through that two-part journey. What benefits could they expect afterwards? Are there any common things that are surprising for people who have gone through that journey and have purged their things and have somehow found this perfect balance of, you know, the things that they need and the things that they own? What does that feel like?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, this is like a lifelong journey. So there is no arrival. Right? I think that's the other thing, because I remember thinking, yes, I'm done. And then realizing 6 months later, oh, I'm never done, right? Like, I'm still letting go of things, right? Because we change, we evolve, we grow. And so do the things that we need, use, and love in our lives. But I think one of the first things that people sort of realize right away is how much lighter they feel, right? Like, you don't even realize how weighty it is to be holding on to things that are not serving you. And so I think one of the first things that people feel is lighter, right? And being able to like truly see, and not only see, but enjoy what they have, right? So for example, if you're going through your closet, yeah, I had so much stuff. I mean, I was a bargain shopper. It was out of control. And I, you know, if it's helpful, I can walk you through like how that process worked for me. So, for example, understanding why I had more than I needed. when I went through that process of self-discovery, looking at all that stuff, I realized, wow, almost everything that I have has a red tag on it. It is literally unworn, but it's on, I got it on clearance. And I was like, what is this about? Like, why am I always buying things on sale and not using them? And what I realized was that, like, growing up, shopping and going to the malls on the weekend with my mom it was just like a pastime. And so shopping to me, and bargain shopping in particular, became synonymous with fun, with relaxation, with treating myself, like all these different things. And I had to really learn, one of the reasons why I had so much more than I needed was because I was a bargain shopper who was in love with the thrill of the hunt, not necessarily the reward, because I never wore anything, but I really, really loved finding a deal, right? And then I had to say, well, why is it so hard for me to let go of these things? I mean, I got them on sale. I'm not wearing them. I'm not using them. And it was because I was really attached to the idea of how much they were worth, whether that worth was actual or perceived. I just couldn't imagine letting go of things that I had spent my hard-earned money on. And again, like, really forgiving myself, right? And going through that grieving process and then saying, okay, I am going to let go of anything that no longer serves me. Whether I can sign it and try and recoup some of the money that I owned. You know, there's always this place that people get to where you only have the nice things left. I like to call it, like, you only have the nice things left. And they're like, oh, I can't give it away. I can't imagine donating it. I can't, you know. And I remember getting to that point and saying, how long am I going to hold on to things that I just don't need, use, and love just because I don't want to let them go? And I like to tell people at that point, like, that's when I came up with the, like, you have to pay it forward. Find an organization, a mission, something in your community, something that you feel passionate about, that you feel is deserving of these pieces. Because you're never going to be able to recoup what you spent. Like, just let it go. It's never gonna happen. And for me, I had all of these, like, fabulous designer suits and things that I had found on sale, and I ended up giving them to Dress for Success. And, like, that was so meaningful to me. And, you know, even now I'll smile, like, and I'll think, you know, there's this black Casper suit that I talk about all the time. And I smile just thinking about, like, wondering what woman got that black Casper suit and just felt like $1 million when she walked into her interview, right? Like, you have to find something that you feel passionate about to let it go. And to answer your question, what you end up feeling is like joy, freedom, less attachment to things, and being more attuned to your authentic self and other things that bring you joy. And so, like, none of these things can be compartmentalized, I feel like, in the way that mainstream minimalism tends to sort of, like, make it so simple, right? It's just so mm-hmm. simple. Just let go of everything and your house will be clean and you will be happy.
Well, that's where I feel like I struggle, because, you know, there are certain things that I have that I love, but I maybe use, like, once a year.
Yeah.
So it's hard, you know, it's hard to figure out where that balance is of, like, do I really need it?
Mm-hmm.
I love it, but how much use does it get? I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Where do you draw the line
balance
there?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So love is always the, like, obviously we love it, right? Like, it's why you brought it in. It's beautiful. It's soft. It's pretty, whatever, right? Obviously you love it. The need, and this is only something that you can define, which is why I'm always like, this is such an individual journey, right? This whole, like, take a little, leave a little, right? Need for me is going to look totally different than need for you. If I only use something once a year, I don't need it. I just don't. But for someone else, that need may be sufficient, right? So for me, need, use, love is the philosophy that I go by, and it has to meet all three elements. I can't just love it, or I can't just need, I have to need, use, and love. But only you can define that need. And oftentimes what people do is they look at future need, or future use. I have heard some of the most, and I have made up this word, I call it fantastical. I have heard some of the most fantastical stories of why people hold on to things for future need or future use. I've heard people say things like, one day this will be vintage. Of course one day it will be vintage.
Yeah.
Of course one day it will be vintage, right? Or, you know, one of the examples that I use in the book, one of my friends, she had this beautiful gown. She like never wore it. And she said, I've just been waiting for like a special occasion. Like maybe Michelle Obama will be there or like Oprah will be there. And I'm like, not to say that this will never happen for you. It's rare. Right.
That's a way to put it, Christine.
It's rare. But in the event that it does happen, I'm pretty sure that if it happens, you will be in a place in your life where you can either buy something that you need or rent something that you need. But holding on to this dress in the hopes that this is going to, right? And so we say all of these things to convince ourselves why we don't have to let something go. And so I like to say, do you need it? Do you use it? Do you love it? So let me ask you, if you're interested in sharing, if it's something personal, that's fine. But what is this thing that you only need and use once a year?
Okay, it's a platter that has two holes in it. You can tie a little ribbon in it to like make it pretty. And then I use it for Easter when my in-laws come over for Easter brunch and I put like little muffins or whatever on it.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's a good one.
And where is it when you're not using this platter? Is it an encumbrance? Is it in the way? Do you ever look at this
Christine
platter?
Christine is cutthroat. For listeners, you can't see Christine's face, her face said, just throw the shit away.
She sure did.
Her face was like, this was hard.
She was like, are you kidding me?
Megan, do you really need this?
I'm waiting for it to be like great grandma's mixer from, you know what I'm saying? I'm like,
Christine's face said, how do I approach Megan with kindness?
She must not have heard the part about the ribbon. It makes it pretty.
I am so glad people cannot see my face because I was trying, but obviously I failed. But this is why, like, you so have to determine these things for yourself, because for me, it is a no-brainer, right? Like, if I don't have room for this platter and I only use this platter, like, at Easter?
That's fair. That's
you see what I'm saying? But, yeah. Like, how much joy does it bring you? And are there other occasions where you can use it, but you just don't?
Right.
You know
Maybe
what I'm
I need
saying?
To use it more. Maybe that's the solution.
Maybe you need to use it more. I'm just saying.
If it's once a year, we know where Christine falls.
I know. Listen, I can't even say I'm not judging because my face gave it away. I'm clearly judging.
So you need to get rid of it,
she
Megan.
She could not believe me.
Get rid of it. There is some other family, some other household that will use it more than the once a year that you seem to be using it. I want to ask you a question that is slightly, so it's on topic, but it's sort of a pivot away from the types of things that we've been discussing that take up space. And that's the idea of digital minimalism.
Mm.
Do you have any thoughts or any opinion on how someone or the legitimacy or the validity of getting rid of a lot of the stuff that just clogs up your phone or clogs up your inbox or that takes up digital space that does not crowd your apartment, does not crowd your house or your garage, but it does take up, I imagine, some type of mental capacity or some amount of time just maintaining it?
Digital clutter is probably so much more prevalent in people's lives than they are willing or care to admit. Right. So I am actually in the midst of a digital declutter and paperless challenge myself.
Ooh, talk us through it.
Here's what I realized. So as I was going on this challenge, and I will be honest, since I judged Megan, I will allow y'all to judge me, right?
Yeah, it's only fair. Here we go. I'm the only one who gets away from this judgment free.
Look, Megan is ready. Do you see her? She's like, yeah, so I have two Gmails, and I have one Gmail that is like just for subscriptions and emails and receipts and all of that, right? And what led me to start this digital declutter was I had opened that inbox and I had 12,000 unread emails. Go ahead, Megan. Say it, Megan.
That kills me. That I can't look at my best friend's inbox, or it like my skeleton will cringe out of my body.
Yeah.
Because I'm an inbox zero person. Like my inner peace is found when I'm at inbox zero. But if I see like just a mix of read and unread and thousands of emails, it's so
and so
brutal.
My personal inbox is on zero, but I have this other inbox, right? Mm-hmm. And it's this mixture, exactly what you said, Jordan. Opened, unopened, and probably I became overwhelmed probably when I was like around 500. And
yeah, then
I just like, I just was like, whatever, right? What I discovered when doing research about digital clutter was that the average person receives 97 emails a day.
Oof.
I know, 97 emails a day. And so what ends up happening is, you know, we see the subject. I'm like, oh, I don't need to open that. And then so it just starts building up and building up and building up. Getting people to understand that this is also affecting our environment. Like our servers have to house this information that we're not using, and that it literally requires more energy to sort of like store some of these unopened and unread emails. Also even like trash that you haven't emptied in your empty trash bins. And so getting people to understand that, like, you really have to go in and dig through. For me, it's 12,000. I hope no one else has to start at that number. But, you know, unsubscribing, right? So many of those emails were like, why did I, it's an old subscription, mm-hmm. something that I don't even use anymore. So, like, very easily unsubscribe from these retailers that you don't need these things, these newsletters that you're no longer reading, you know, that is going to cut down on the daily emails that you receive. Going through and deleting. And now here's the other thing. There are many different approaches to this. I have seen approaches that are like, start a year, whatever day you start, go back a year and delete everything.
And
like,
just,
don't even look at it.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
I know, right? That's probably what I should have done.
I thought about doing that for Twitter. There's like programs where you can just set a date and just obliterate your Twitter prior to that specific date. It's like, should I just do the nuclear option there?
Yeah. But you know what, Jordan? It's the same thing that happens with our wardrobes and things at our house. It's this loss aversion that happens, right? And we're just like, well, what if there's something there that I need? There's nothing there that I need, right? Like the same way I was judging Megan about her platter. Right. There's no email there that I need or that I check, you know, or dig for once a year that I need to hold on to. Right. And so learning to just like really in the same way that we declutter a lot of our personal inboxes because it is just so overwhelming, doing that with those subscriptions and newsletters and all those things. Also, you know, a lot of people have, I think the average person has like five email accounts, six emails, like email accounts, like getting that down to two or three, that will help as well with digital declutter. Understanding that digital declutter also means decluttering and like organizing the apps on your phone, on your desktop, like all of these things just sort of lead to a sort of mental clarity and simplicity that just make life easier. It doesn't seem like it will, right? Like, are you kidding me? Like, so you're trying to tell me if I put all my apps in this one, like all my productivity apps in this folder and all my this apps in that folder, it's going to make your life easier because it's not cluttered and it's not a distraction. I don't know if any of you have ever, like any of your friends, you know, you look at their computer and they have like 10,000 tabs open and you're just like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yep.
And that's
absolutely.
Like, right? That's how it feels every time we look at our brains feel every time we look at our phones and these cluttered inboxes, right? And so I'm a big fan of digital decluttering. And I am in the midst of that myself and can acknowledge it is not easy. Probably as hard for me as it is for Megan to let go of this platter with the ribbon that you can tie, right? We all have our thing. We all have our thing.
Can I ask one last question just to wrap up here, Christine? If someone is getting started, should they start big or should they start small? Should Megan start by getting rid of that one single platter and maybe a few other things, you know, in a few weeks? Or should someone like Megan or me or whoever else who might be interested in it, and I don't want to just pick on Megan,
but should someone,
you know.
Poor Megan and her platter, man. We have given that right, platter yeah, that, a
that,
hard
that,
time.
I'm buying another one. I'm buying a second platter.
But like, do you see what I'm saying? Like, should someone start small or should someone empty out their closet the way that you did and dump it all out and sort through it that way?
Yeah.
Which way would you recommend for someone to get started?
This is a great question. So I never want anyone to go through what I went through. So that is not going to be my recommendation. So there are literally, you know, there are many different approaches, but I would say there are like two common approaches. And I like to call it, so one is called quick, fast, and in a hurry, and I'll explain that in a second. And the other is called slow and steady. I'm a big fan of slow and steady, okay? Quick, fast, and in a hurry is when you literally, you don't have a choice, right? Maybe you're a military family that's moving. Maybe you've been given 1 month to take a job overseas, right? Like there is some finite time in which you need to downsize and declutter to move or to whatever you are doing with your life, like you have a finite moment in time. And so that's when you would use the quick, fast, and in a hurry approach. And the way that works is you get a number of storage boxes, you fill them with those things that you think you want to let go of, that you no longer need, use, and love. And so I'm laughing because this would not work for Megan because she only uses it once a year. You would put it in a box and you essentially seal the box. And if you don't go in that box within that finite window, then you just go ahead and donate it sealed, right? So that's quick, fast, and in a hurry. You're getting rid of it. Chances are you're never going to go back in that box, right? And so that's one approach. Slow and steady is the approach that I recommend for most people. And believe it or not, people who are like really struggling, I recommend like just start with your spice cabinet, right?
Ooh, that's
because
a good
what happens
I got, I got a lot in there.
Listen,
it's got to be expired by now.
I could get rid of some spices. I
you
do
see
that.
What I'm
yeah.
saying?
Like yeah.
you go in there and you're like, really? This is a rock. Like whatever.
I don't even know what this is even for. What is coriander? I don't know. Why am I pretending like I know what this is?
You shake it and it's like, you know, a boulder in there. Right. And so
it's just one block. Yeah.
So I like to encourage people, like start with something. If you feel like super overwhelmed, because there are people that are like, I'm ready. I'm just going to dig in. Like by all means have at it. I always say, whatever time you think it's going to take, double or triple that time. Because that's the other thing. People always underestimate time. They're like, oh my goodness, it's only going to take me 2 hours to go. And I'm like, it's probably going to take you 6, right? So understanding if you do choose to like tackle an entire closet, that it's not going to be this 2 hour, 3 hour plan that you had. But when you do slow and steady, I feel like it takes a lot of pressure off of you, right? One of the challenges that I started on Instagram was actually encouraging people to let go of one thing every day for 1 year.
A year? I thought you were going to say a week. I thought you might have said a month.
One thing a day.
Year.
And I'm like, at the end of the year, you will have let go at a minimum 365 things, right? And so there's so many people who signed up for that challenge because they were like, okay, this just takes so much pressure off of me. And they go in their closet and they're like, I'm going to let go of one thing. And then maybe some days they let go of 30. Some days they let go of 60. But some days they're overwhelmed and they let go of one, right? But it's this idea that slowly and surely you will get to this place of reaching your goal, living with less, you know, feeling this feeling of liberation, without the pressure that comes with trying to make this like this weekend warrior mission. A weekend to declutter everything that you have accumulated over the last several decades, right?
Like, no, that's misery.
When you say it aloud, it sounds absolutely like impossible. And for most people, it just is. And I'm just like, why are you putting this amount of pressure on yourself, especially when this is a never ending journey? And so those are my approaches. Like, I'm like, this is how you start. Sometimes you just start with one thing. We all have suffered from overconsumption at some point, right? And so like getting people to understand, like, once you understand why you have more than you need and why it's so hard to let go, to like really tackling this in a manageable way for you, because it is, it's a lifestyle change. And the idea that you can make this mindset shift and lifestyle shift in a weekend, or, you know, as TV shows make it appear, in like an hour, like, it's just so unrealistic. And I hate to see people set up for failure. So for me, slow and steady is my recommendation. And if you are completely overwhelmed, start with your spice cabinet.
This is more inspired than I've been for a long time. And I will definitely start with my spice cabinet this week. Because there's no doubt there are things that
you
can absolutely
go. You see what I'm saying? And then like, once you have this organized spice cabinet, you feel empowered to like, maybe you move to the coffee mugs.
Move on to the next thing.
I have like a whole theory about mugs. I'm like, somehow they're reproducing. I don't know how, but there's no way that I bought all of these mugs.
Oh, man. Christine, this was absolutely great. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing these tips.
This was so fun. No, thank you all so much.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Now it's time for Upgrade of the Week, where we talk about that one thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Megan, what's your upgrade this week?
Okay, so my upgrade is more of a process than an actual item.
Tell me more.
So I come from a family where we buy greeting cards for like every occasion. We're just constantly sending each other greeting cards for Mother's Day, birthday, anniversaries. Mm-hmm. And I tend to get them from the same place, which is the Walgreens pharmacy right up the street from me. Mm-hmm. And they just have no selection. It's just such a sad thing to go in there and constantly be going through the same card. I actually bought my dad the same birthday card like 3 years in a row because it was the only one at the store that I liked. So obviously, that's ridiculous. That's a waste of money. So I've started thinking ahead and ordering all my greeting cards on Etsy.
Nice.
Which you can find like super cute, super personalized, you know, unique stuff from people who, you know, are running their own business. And so it's like you're supporting, you know, a local artist, local creator, and you're also getting a card that you actually like and feel like it's worth spending $5 on.
That is such a good idea. And I didn't realize until pretty recently that you could get greeting cards from Etsy, which I shouldn't have been surprised about. Etsy has everything. But I stumbled across it by accident because I was looking for a meme of, did you watch Schitt's Creek?
Yeah.
Okay. So I was looking for a meme of Alexis saying, like, I love that for you. And I couldn't find this meme. And on Google Images, it popped up. It took me to Etsy. And there was someone who had a greeting card of a drawing of Alexis saying, I love that for you. And it was such a cool card. And
oh,
I have it.
Perfect.
Yeah, it would be such a good greeting card to use. And I was like, oh, okay. Etsy has greeting cards. I'd never thought of this before. But that's such a good upgrade. That's awesome.
Yeah. And what is your upgrade, Jordan?
So mine is, again, going to be related to my dog. And I, like many people, have a big basket of toys for my dog. And I got this advice because my dog, you know, she'll dig through this basket and sometimes she'll pick out her favorite toy. But most of the toys that she had once fallen in love with, she like doesn't really care about anymore. And I had gotten the advice that you should never keep all of your dog toys available to your dog at the same time, because they'll just pick their favorite and they will leave the rest alone. But instead, you should have one basket that's available and then keep the other half of their toys away from them and just swap them out. And that's how, that way, every time that you swap out your dog's toys, they don't recall that, you know, this was an old toy that they stopped playing with. To them, it's just a new toy again. So you just sort of psychologically to your dog, you've doubled the amount of toys. And whenever they see their new toys, they'll have newfound interest to play with things that they forgot that they had loved. So that's the upgrade. Keep half of your dog toys away from your dog and then swap it out every now and then, just like you got new toys.
Okay. As Life Hacker's parenting editor, I feel it necessary to point out that this is also a great tactic with toddlers.
Nice.
After a holiday or a birthday, when they get a bunch of toys, they are not going to remember the next day, even the next hour, all the different stuff they got. You hide half of that.
Yes.
And rotate it out.
Kids and dogs. Win-win. Good stuff.
So many similarities.
Awesome. And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. You can also reach us by calling us at 347-687-8109 and leaving a voicemail, or write to us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find us on Twitter @lifehacker, on Instagram @lifehacker.com, that's all one word, and on Facebook @facebook.com/lifehacker. You can sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks, all at lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find notes for this show and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/this show.